be available to you, plus the PowerPoints, if you'd like it. Just give me your business cards, and I'll send it to you. Before we start, I would like you to look around, and if you know the person that you're with, in other words, you've been with that person a number of times before in other settings, in other meetings, I'd like you to get up and sit next to somebody you don't know. I mean, one of the purposes of this whole evening is to meet new people. You're not going to be meeting new people by sitting next to the people that you know very well. Just sit over there. Come on, mix it up. You too, guys.
That's good, Larry. I like that. That's good.
Great. Thank you.
I've heard you speak.
Okay, you're gonna have plenty of opportunities to talk with each other this evening.
John Taylor.
Okay, let me start. I started my partner Mary Ann Peabody and I started Stibel Peabody as retained search, leadership development, and executive outplacement. We started in 1979. I know what you're thinking, and you're absolutely right. That I was really precocious. I started at the company at the age of 5. What can I tell you? Now, my first client is right over here. This is a Honeywell product. You've probably seen them in your offices, in buildings all over the world. They were my first client. Honeywell makes regulatory systems for heating, fire, air conditioning. They are extremely reliable. They're unglamorous. Honeywell is a Minneapolis company, has Midwestern values. Perfect, perfect. But in the early 80s, they looked at companies like the late Digital Equipment Corporation and Prime Computers and Data General, and they said, boy, this mini computer stuff is really hot. We ought to get into that. And so they came to Boston and they started something called USISG, United States Information Systems Groups. Later, the French got involved and it was called Bull. Anybody remember Bull? Okay. Disaster. Total disaster. You know, a nice Midwestern company dealing with control systems and stability, going into a market where the product life cycle is like a year, 2 years, it was a disaster. But of course, Honeywell was not alone in this disaster. Around this time, Sears was the place where the middle class would shop, and they said, well, we've got all this credibility selling power equipment, why don't we sell tax advice? No, didn't work. Exxon said, oh, we got all this credibility selling oil, it was selling you gas, why don't we sell computers? No, didn't work. And in response to that, there came this trend in the 70s that I call stay in your lane. If you're a company, you've got a certain expertise. You're with a Wall Street company that provides investment advice. Don't get in the oil business. You don't belong in the oil business. Stay in your lane. Indeed, there was a book out that some of you may have read called In Search of Excellence. How many read In Search of Excellence? So that whole thing was stay in your lane, or what they called stick to your knitting. Do what you do best, and don't get out of that. As late as the early, probably 10 years ago, there was a popular book out called From Good to Great. How many of you read that? Jim Collins' book. They talked about the difference between hedgehogs and foxes. And you want to be a hedgehog, just focus on what's in front of you, don't be a fox. So stay in your lane. Stick to your knitting. Now, in our work with CFOs, general counsels, chief HRO officers, we often hear stay in your lane mentality. And the two versions go something like this. You're the chief financial officer, you're the smartest financial guy in the room. and I'm the general counsel, I'm the smartest legal guy in the room. We're going to cooperate by staying in our lanes. I'm not going to get into finance, you're not going to get into law. As long as we keep that separation, we're going to just be fine. If there's something needs to be decided, we'll let the CEO decide, and that's it. We're going to stay in our lanes. How many are familiar with this? How many have heard this? Now there's a version of stay in your lane, and it goes something like this. I'm a big corporate guy. I'm really interested in the company as a whole. Of course, my lane is the lane, right? I'm the CFO, and you know, and it's basic. A company is a money machine. If it's generating more money relative to its expenses, it's a profitable company. If it's generating less money to it relative to its expenses, it's not a profitable company. Any questions? Therefore, finance is the most important function, and as long as I stay in my lane, the company is going to be fine. And you see the same thing. HR will say, look, at the end of the day, it's all about people. My job is attracting, retaining, and motivating people. Therefore, what I do is the most important lane in the company. Stay in my lane. My lane is the lane. Now, I'd like you to discuss this among you in your own experiences. Have you heard this in your own careers? And how effective has it been? If you've heard it from bosses or presidents, discuss it with each other. Stay in your lane. Is this a tendency you still see? Is this a tendency you have? Is this your philosophy?
Well, I think that a lot of companies.
I'll give you 3 minutes.
This is what's important, because sometimes I really like to move when people around, get them out of their comfort zone. I think I'm going to adopt that for every meeting.
Yeah, you can. It's easy. It's just a structure to do.
I want to know where the CEO
Okay, I'll give you one more minute, and then we'll move on. Okay. So, stay in your lane has been a prevailing sense within the C-suite. You stay in your lane, I'll stay in my lane. We won't have any problems. But wait a second. Is that the way the world is working now? Let's look at what's going on in the world. CVS is not staying in its lane. It's buying Aetna, which is an insurance company. What's that all about? Amazon. It's not staying in its lane. I thought they did. You buy stuff online. Now they're getting into the retail market. What's that all about? And of course, the ones I love. Who would have thought a furniture store would become a movie theater? Look at Capital One. Capital One is a smush of a bank and a coffee shop.
Yes.
What's that about? The thing I love is going to Copley Square in the Boston Public Library. It has a coffee shop in it. And in the middle of the coffee shop is a radio studio. Who would have thought a library, a coffee shop, a radio studio? We're now dealing with the world of schmush, where things are put on top of things that don't seem to make sense, but maybe they do. So the goal is to talk about some research that my company has done, first with chief human resources officers, then with general counsels, and then to see, would this apply to chief financial officers? And my guess is, yes, it would. Let me talk first about the research procedure that we did. We went to, when I say we, I'm talking about Marianne Peabody, myself, and my partner in Atlanta. We went to a number of chief executive officers and asked this one question. On a scale of 0 to 10, I believe my chief human resources officer is a valued business advisor. If the CEO said 7 or below, we said thank you very much and went on. If the person said 8 or higher, we interviewed the CEO and then we interviewed the CHRO. Now, we did about 20 of these interviews, but you know, most of HR people are women. And we said, maybe there's kind of a sex thing going on here. So let's try with a male-dominated function. So we looked at general counsels. We went to CEOs and said, same question. On a scale of 0 to 10, I would rate my general counsel as a valued business advisor. If they said 7 or less, we didn't talk with them. If they said 8 or more, we interviewed the general counsel and we interviewed the CEO. We did not find any difference in terms of sex. It was not about male versus female. So what were the findings? The first major finding is what I call the most important question. The most important question, and that is the person conscientious? Well, usually, to get to become a CFO or a CEO or complete any kind of long-term education, the answer to that is obvious. They are conscientious, so you don't even have to ask that. The second question is this. How open is this person to new ideas on a scale of 0 to 10? This is called the Big Five Personality Factors. I'm a psychologist, and the Big Five Personality Factors is well researched since the 1960s. There are five core personality factors. Most of the tests of the marketplace are measuring these five cores, and one of those is called openness to new experiences. So here's the very specific recommendation that I would ask you to do if you are a job candidate. Ask the person who you would be reporting to, on a scale of 0 to 10, how open are you to new experiences? The person will give you a number, says, that's great. If I ask your subordinates the same question, what number would they give me? Now, the answer you want is, that's a good question, why don't you ask them? If the answer is, oh, they'll give me a 10 and they would say I'm firm but fair and I have an open door policy, you probably won't get the job because you asked the question. But that may be a good idea that you don't get the job. Let me give you a couple of examples of how we've used this one question. I have an outplacement candidate who's a CEO type person approached by a recruiter to become CEO of a private equity portfolio company in an industry that is adjacent to the industry that my client knows extremely well. My client knows the company, he knows the competitors, he's walked into a number of the facilities to see what the product is about, he's talked to a number of the key customers, and he had like a list of 10 things that he could see for improving the company. And he's really, really excited about this. And then he goes to the recruiter and he asks this question of the recruiter. On a scale of 0 to 10, how open is this private equity partner to new ideas? The recruiter, much to his surprise, says 2. He says, 2? He says, yeah. The private equity partner has really put enough money into this company, doesn't want to put any more money into it. He has a plan for improving growth. He fired the last CEO because the CEO wouldn't implement his plan. He's got a plan. He's looking for somebody to implement that plan. Voila. In other words, they're really not looking for a CEO. They're looking for a COO who will be given the title COO. Another example. I'm doing a search for a company and the chief executive officer is an Israeli business guy who worked, who came from the Mossad. Any of you ever worked with Israeli business? They are, let's put it this way, they are aggressive. They're challenging. They're in your face. And this guy is exactly this way. So, and I'm recruiting for somebody who's going to report to this guy, and I just assumed that he's just in your face all the time. So I talked to the subordinates and asked this one question. On a scale of 0 to 10, how open is this guy to new ideas? They said 9 or 10. I said, really? 9 or 10? That's how he comes across. They said, yeah, he's Israeli. They all do that. If you have an idea, he'll push you. You'll have to defend your idea. You have to provide evidence. But if you've got your numbers, he'll give it some serious thought, and he's open to change. I had not thought of him that way until I asked that question. So job candidates, do ask this question. How open to new ideas is this person? It is not always the case that the higher the number, the better. Sometimes it could be worse. For example, Beth works in life sciences. Some people who are CEOs of life sciences companies are so bright, so intelligent, so inquisitive, they can't focus. And any new idea is wonderful. They want to focus on the next new idea. So asking the question brings out the qualities that you're looking for. So one of the things that we find is that in successful business advisors, the CEO is usually rated as an 8, 9, or 10. And the C-suite person is rated as an 8, 9, or 10. So there's a consistency in this one factor, openness to new ideas. And that's the question. So now I'm going to give you 3 minutes. I'd like you to discuss with each other how you could implement this idea if you're a job candidate looking for a job, or if you're currently employed, how would you implement this when you're looking to recruit candidates? So please discuss it with each other for 3 minutes.
I just realized I skipped over having them introduce themselves.
Right.
I don't want to do it now because it's going to break your flow. So I think at the end of your flow, I think I'm going to do it then. Does that make sense?
At the end, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to do it now. You've got a good flow going.
Yeah.
So. I hesitated. I'm saying I'm forgetting something, and I did.
Yeah, you. We'll get to it. But this is good. You can hear the conversation going.
One more minute to go.
I'm in a transition and I spent a lot of time.
what are you like?
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let's move on. By the way, why you've been sitting for a long time. Stand up. Come on, stand up and stretch. Come on, stretch. Yeah, yeah. Good, good. All right, sit down. That's enough. You're having too much fun. All right. Here's the second major finding from our research. I'm here to tell you that your mother was right. She. How many of you, your mother ever told you never get a second chance to make a good first impression? Okay, your mother was right. She's right. Yeah. The first day that you meet, if you are an incumbent and a new CEO is coming in, that first conversation, that first meeting is going to set the tone for subsequent meetings. Now, thankfully, many of you are CFOs, and CFOs have to work with the boards of directors. So if you are the incumbent CFO and a new CEO comes in, what's the most important thing for the CEO? It's probably the management of the board that just elected him. So if you can start that first meeting and say, look, I've been involved with the company for 3 years, I've been working with the audit committee, and I know everybody else on the board. I know them socially, I know them professionally. If I can be a resource for you in terms of the board, I'm here for you. So you start the relationship off in the area that he's most concerned about. So you start at the top. Any questions, comments, concerns? Any of you have any experience with something like this? Okay.
Hey, Larry. I'm so sorry to advise.
Yeah, no.
But we had a question that was really interesting.
Okay.
How did, in your research, people react to being asked that question?
How open
are you to new ideas? Not what was their answer, but how did they react?
The question when I ask somebody, how open are you to new ideas, I'm expecting them to say 7, 8, or 9. Because everybody thinks they are. It's when I'm asking the people that report to them that question that's important.
Like where we were going, or where I was going with my question, I don't mean to take up the time, was we were wondering if people got really defensive. And said, oh no, I'm really good with new ideas.
Well, I'm asking for a number. And I don't care what the number is, but then they have to explain why they picked the number that they did. And in the explanation, they may say 9, but as they explain it, they're really not that open to new ideas. Next, where is your location? Location, location, location. You're in real estate, right? What's the 3 most important things in real estate?
Yes, sir.
Location, location, location. Where is your office in relationship to the CEO? Guess what? If you're in the CFO's office, you're in the VP of communications office, and you are in the one floor down, or you're in the next building, you're in a ghetto. You're in a ghetto. What's the probability the CEO's going to walk down one floor to see you? Or if he's in the next building, what's the probability the CEO's going to come to the next building to see you? So, to the extent possible, a lot of the valued business advisor is a function of where is your office in relationship to the CEO's office. So to the extent possible, if you are a candidate and you're in an interview, that's a question you want to ask. Where would be my office? And if the person, if they say, well, you're going to be in the finance and accounting department, and the finance and accounting department's on the 6th floor and the CEO's on the 8th floor, that's not a good sign. Now, what do you do if that's the case? Well, here's an example of one of the things I'm doing with my current clients. She is a vice president of finance. She's the CFO, but she's in a different building. This is higher education, so she's in a completely different building. The CEO has a boardroom right outside his office, and it's a glass. It's all glass, so when you walk, you see who's in the boardroom. She makes sure that at 4:45 every day, just when the secretary is getting ready to leave, if that room is empty, she's going to be there with her laptop and going to be doing work. Usually the CEO gets out of the office at 5:30 to 6, sees her in the boardroom, goes in and says, why are you here? She says, I'm waiting for you. Wanted to see if I could be of help. And that happened like 2 days in a row, and by the third day, the CEO is expecting her to be there. And then he starts using her as a debriefing. Here's what happened today, and here's what I'm planning to do tomorrow. And now she's got that trusted, valued advisor role. But if you're in the ghetto, you're not going to get that. So you want to make sure that you are physically in the right place.
Larry.
Yep.
With so many companies virtual and people all over the place, how do you deal with that?
Again, if you're looking for, I'm assuming most of the people in this room are looking for a role like a CFO. I'm not sure how you handle that on a virtual basis. Right. You've just got to have the relationship.
Not sending an email.
No, sending an email a couple of times a day, just it's not the same as just physically being there.
But are you seeing that with your clients?
Yeah.
Are more geographically dispersed, and they live in California?
But usually at the C-suite, they want people close by. At the divisional level, yeah, maybe. Certainly if you're looking at a more technical job, sure, if they can live anywhere. But if your goal is to bond with your CEO and be perceived as a valued business advisor, you want to physically be there. I remember early in my career, I was a psychologist stationed at a community health center, like in a very poor area. And my boss was never, ever in this poor area. He was always at the corporate headquarters. And I thought to myself as a young person, what a suck up this guy is. He's not where the action is. The action is where the patients are. He's there in the corporate headquarters sucking up. Now I understand he's perfectly right. If he stayed with us, he would have been forgotten. He was better able to be an advocate for us physically being in the headquarters. So if you're in a ghetto, you want to get out of the ghetto. Be prepared to bring your laptop to the CEO's office. Just hang around. Be there when everybody else is gone. So, now I'd like you to discuss this for 3 minutes. How does this relate to what you've seen in your careers? How does this relate to what you might be doing in your next job?
I like the just in some of the things I've seen over my career. It's like, it's the old story about your perspective on a situation. It's not that you're right or wrong, you just have your own.
That's right.
But you might have completely misunderstood certain situations. But I think you're right. I think despite the obstacle, like the question was asked about the age of the people on physically together, and it makes a whole bit of difference. And a quick story was like my son, when he's a mechanical engineer at GE, and when he went through their co-op program at Northeastern, and he did all 3 co-ops there. And early on, I said to him, your success is about relationships. It's not about your technical skill. It's about people. So I said, you're probably gonna look at me crazy, but I said, what you need to do is you need to be selective, because you can't do this every day in every situation, but start something comes up, you'll know when it's really important. Don't send a text. Don't make a phone call. Don't send an email.
Right.
Get up off your butt. Go walk over to the person's office. I don't care if they're in the next building, whatever. And basically just say, hey, you know, we got a couple minutes to chat about what you're all sitting there. And immediately he was getting like, no one does this. And I said, you did it with blue collar, white collar, because as an engineer, he's dealing with people off the plant. And I said, because once people believe that you're sincere, not just words, and they're going to see it because you took the time. And one of the really senior guys, one of the VPs, said, you took the time to come and see me to talk about this. It's like, wow. He said, no one ever does that anymore. And I said, so now, you know, you're going to be unique. And I said, it's a simple thing, but if you do these things, you know, it goes a long way.
Amen.
But you've got to find a way. And it's like, if you really want to be the valued CFO or whatever your title is, the principle still applies. You got to be available when someone needs it, even though there's not a specific meeting. Because if you're not accessible, then that person, whether it's the CEO or someone else in the position of authority, isn't going to come looking for you.
That's right.
It's not the way it works. Because a lot of people, one of my positions, I was at DEC and I worked in central engineering. And people used to like, why do they have this row of VPs? And it's like, why? Where would you expect them to sit with their businesses? I said, because they're all here, as events happen, they can interact with each other real time. You can't do that if you're offering your business in Nashua and someone's in another town. Because you can always deal with your team. You can go visit your team. But as an executive, you got to be where the action is.
That's right. Okay. All right. Next major finding. I mean, you're going to have to trust me that this really does happen. A lot of CEOs, when they look at people like you, their attitude is, you've seen one, you've seen them all. You know? Yeah, you got, okay, you got an MBA and a CPA, and you worked for a big four CPA firm, and then you were a controller, and you moved up, and hey, I've seen them before. You've seen one, you've seen them all. And so your opening lines, when you're talking to a recruiter, your opening line when you're talking to a CEO is this: I'm not your typical CFO. Because the CFO's already, the jobs you're looking for, the person who's going to hire you has probably already hired several CFOs in his or her career. And it's got a stereotype about what a CFO is supposed to be. So you come in and say, I'm not your typical CFO, sort of says, what? Tell me more. And that allows you to present yourself. If you fail to start your opening line with, I'm not your typical CFO, the presumption is you are the typical CFO. You know, you and I have not talked very much. We've only met for like 3 minutes. But if you come from, what was the name of the company? BNY Mellon. I have a stereotype of BNY Mellon. So the presumption is you're typical of BNY Mellon type people. If you came from Goldman Sachs, I have a stereotype of Goldman Sachs. So I'd say, well, you must be typical of Goldman Sachs people until you prove me otherwise.
What happens if they want a typical CFO?
I'd say, what?
What happens if they want a typical CFO? When they are searching for a CFO, right?
Yeah, they are searching. They may be looking for
a traditional.
Yeah, if they're looking for somebody traditional and that's what you want, that's fine. I'm, again,
separating.
I'm separating out, if you have a stay in your lane philosophy, I want to be the smart, my goal is to be the smartest finance person in the room and respected for being the smartest finance person in the room, then stay, just disregard everything I'm saying.
If your goal is, I want to be the CEO's valued advisor, who, oh, by the way, happens to be the CFO, that's what this is for. So implications. Your theme should be, I'm not your typical. And then explain why you're not the typical. Next finding, blurred boundaries. Again, this depends on what you want. If you want to be your typical CFO, stay in your lane, you want to keep the boundaries tight. What is in my lane, what is in your lane? Let's get it clear. If you are into being the CEO's valued business advisor, you want to go for blurring boundaries as quickly as possible. I'm going to give you two examples. I'm working now with a chief human resources officer for a large healthcare system. And she's using me as her coach for how does she create a platform for success so she will be successful in this hospital. So again, the idea is you never get a second chance to make a good first impression. What I suggested she do in the first week of her tenure as chief HR officer is to spend Saturday night in the emergency room. For any of you how many of you have ever been in an emergency room on a Saturday night? You know, it goes like this. You know, there are periods when there's just nothing going on, in which case the CHRO can talk to the employees about what is it like to work in a hospital. And then there are times when it's just totally chaos and the place is overrun with, and then you just got to back off and just observe what's going on. But the idea was to start the relationship by saying, I, as the head of human resources, understand that the core of this business is the patient treatment area. And the most difficult part of that is the crisis and emergency unit. So that's where I want to start. So it was a symbolic act. What she did later, however, was she made sure that every senior HR person would spend a Friday night or a Saturday night in the emergency room and talk with the people in the emergency room. Eventually the word got out throughout the hospital that HR was out of the ghettos, actually talking to people who are actually delivering services as opposed to filling out forms and making requirements on us. They were actually interested in what we're doing with patients, HR. That word got out. So it was a great way to start the relationship. My best example of blurring boundaries was, I had a friend who went to Harvard Business School. She was a Harvard marketing person, and she gets a job in Dallas, Texas, and she walks in on her first day, and her boss says, okay, I'm gonna refer you now to Russell, and he's going to set you up to deliver potato chips. And she says, I don't think you understand. I was hired to be director of marketing, and I have an MBA from Harvard Business School. And you're asking me to go to deliver potato chips? I don't understand. He says, let me explain this to you. Our potato chips are no better, no worse than anybody else's. Our prices are set by a very competitive market. We can't go up, we can't go down. The only thing that differentiates from everybody else is our store door delivery system, which is excellent. That's why we get the prominent placement that we do. If you don't understand the store door delivery system, you don't understand Frito-Lay. Get in the truck. He's absolutely right. What is the core in particular business? Are you with the core? Are you spending time with the core, or are you spending time in the finance ghetto? So what you want to do is to try to blur boundaries. Another way that people in our study blurred boundaries is with a phrase, and it goes something like this. If I put my CFO hat on, here's what I would say. However, if I take my CFO hat on and I put my shareholder value hat on, here's what I would say. This allows you to say two different things in response to the same issue from different perspectives, but using the hat analogy allows you to take two different positions and not be contradictory. Because a lot of times, things you may find in terms of, from a risk perspective as a CFO, you may want to say, we shouldn't dare do this. On the other hand, in terms of our brand and our reputation, maybe we should. You can wear different hats. Blur boundaries. Create opportunities for your staff to blur, to get out of their ghettos, to see what's going on. One of the things I was always impressed with Dell Manufacturing is that Michael Dell would spend one half of one day a year manning the call centers. It's a symbol. I know, it's just a symbol. But it's his way of sending a message to the company that the customer service area is so important. I'm there. I got a headphone on. I'm answering questions. This is important. So now I'd like you to discuss this in terms of your own experiences, what you have seen, but also what you might do in your current jobs or your next job. I'll give you 3 minutes. One minute left.
Okay.
Okay. So, now we're coming to the end, and let's summarize. My company did research to look at chief executive officers who found their chief HR officers or their chief legal officers were perceived by them as valued business advisors and not just the smartest functional professional in the room. What separates those two, those people? As this slide says, not everybody can do it, and also not everybody should do it. Some of you should be the smartest CFO in the room, and that's good enough. And maybe that, for some of you, that's all the CEO wants you to be. So I'm not prescribing this for everyone. Anyway, if you're interested in being the CEO's valued business advisor, you want to focus on being hired by the right kind of person. And one of the ways to find that out is to ask this question. On a scale of 0 to 10, how open is this CEO to new ideas? 0 is never, 10 is always. Pick a number, explain your answer. Ask yourself that question, or even better yet, find someone to ask people who know you that question on a scale of 0 to 10. How old do they think you are? If you're really on the low side, maybe you shouldn't go this route. Are you insightful enough about yourself? If not, get a third party to ask the question. In your interviews, stress how untypical you are of other CFOs. Remember, the person who's considering you for employment has hired many CFOs in the past, so they've got a framework and a bias and a reference point. Are you going to play into that or be different from it? Does the position report directly to the chief executive officer? Of course, the answer is it should. If the answer is it reports to the COO or the chief administrative officer, it's going to be hard for you to be the valued business advisor for the CEO. Where is your office in relationship to the CEOs? If you're on another floor or you're in another building, you're in a ghetto. How are you going to get out of that ghetto and have accidental FaceTime with the CEO? Remember, stay in your lane was, and to some degree still is, a mid-20th century framework. But it's being changed, and we're seeing exciting businesses not stay in their lanes. In order for them to remain viable, they have to hire people who don't stay in their lanes. You want to get the reputation of being outstanding in your specialty, which is finance, but also knowing how to blur. Now, for any of you who would like an MP3, a file of this talk, I'm recording it, and I can also send you the PowerPoint slides. Any comments, questions, or concerns? If not?
We got to your openness question. Do you actually ask directly, or do you have some other way of asking the same question? What I was saying, are you open to new ideas?
Well, first of all, you can ask the recruiter. On a scale of 0 to 10, what do you think? You're probably going to be interviewed by other people that report to the CEO. You can ask that question as well. Yep?
You're currently being interviewed by CEO. The CFO has already gone through the selection process, so wouldn't the question be, what is it about me that interests you, as opposed to me telling you what I think you want to hear?
Usually, by the time you get to the CEO's office, you've gone through other interviews, particularly with the recruiters, and the recruiters will tell you why the CEO is interested in you.
Right, but I guess you haven't heard it from the CEO.
Right.
Or from the recruiters.
Yeah.
So you want to hear from the horse's mouth.
Sure.
So
yeah.
Wouldn't it be kind of a way of figuring that out and then kind of turning these
The perfectly legitimate question to ask. Yep. Other question? Yes, sir.
So Larry, going back to the beginning of the presentation, stay in your lane, right?
Yep.
Company being really good at what they do.
Yep.
But now being open to new ideas, right?
Yep.
And we were talking about that earlier. From your perspective, how would, you know, either the company or us as individuals would aim to have a balance combining the two?
You've got to be an expert in your functional area just to be considered a candidate. So, you know, everybody in this room is going to get high marks for experience in your particular area. The unknown is to the degree to which you are a business person as opposed to a finance person. And again, this conversation is appropriate for certain companies. It's not appropriate for other companies. You really want to do your research about the company, about the strategy of the company, what decisions have they been recently doing, what's going on in the industry. That'll tell you a lot. Again, my experience is, in a lot of large cap businesses, they really want CFOs who are first business people and then CFOs. They really want that. And in a lot of family businesses, they really just want somebody to do the CFO job, and the CEO will do the CEO job. So it depends on a lot of things.
Yeah. I'm curious, Brian. A lot of companies I've been interviewing on, they give psychological tests.
Yeah.
What's the benefit? What's the benefit? I mean, they ask genetic 50 questions.
Well,
I'm just curious.
Most of the tests that are given on the market are versions of the Big Five personality factors. And I'm going to give you a biased answer because I am a psychologist, yeah. and I give some of these tests. Yeah. How do you get valid information from a job candidate in 2018? Do you look at the resume? Well, in many cases, the resume was professionally prepared by an outplacement firm, or you got spell checker. So you can only tell so much. What about how the candidate conducts himself or herself in a job interview? Show of hands, how many of you have ever hired somebody whose greatest job skill was that they knew how to do a job interview?
Yeah.
Couldn't do the job, but man, they did a great job in the job interview. You know, doing a job interview is a little like playing tennis. You can read a book about tennis, you can watch a movie about tennis, but there's only one way you're going to get better at playing tennis. Play tennis. It's the same with job interviews. You can read a book about it, you can watch a movie, you can go to a lecture, but there's only one way you're going to get better, and that's do more job interviews. And thankfully, in this economy, with all the turbulence going on, many of the candidates we see have multiple chances to do well in job interviews. Next, references. How effective are references? Well, with all the legal biases that are going on, most people only give name, dates, and phone numbers, and you call people, they're only going to say positive things. It's really hard to get a negative reference about somebody these days. So how do you get valid information? So psychological test is another tool to assist. In many cases, it is a piece of information. I find it, again, depending on the test, but most of them are basically the Big Five. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Again, if you want, give me your card, and I'll be glad to give you the slides and the MP3. You had a question?
Well, I was just wondering, what is the typical psychological profile, then, as to how you should answer these questions? Because I've taken them myself, and I'm like, this is just, I am who I am. I can't change my personality. And in some jobs that I've interviewed for, like, I've been told, oh, you know, your personality, they've alluded to the test. And I don't know if it was positive or negative. And I'm like, well, there must have been something about that test that.
I will tell you what I tell candidates.
Yeah.
You could try to fake the test out and give the answers that you think the test is looking for, but that's going to be self-defeating.
Yeah.
Because the test is designed to identify people who are trying to fake it. There are questions that are thrown in which are deliberately designed to trap people who are trying to fake good. You know, I've never had bad breath. Yes, no. No, I've never had bad breath. That would be one example. Another example is there are questions that are basically repetitions of the same questions, but asked in a slightly different format to see how consistent you are. So if you try to fake the test, you probably will come out poorly. Second is the test is being used as a screening device to make sure there is a good cultural fit between you and the job. And if you quote unquote fail, that may not necessarily be a bad thing. Let me give a really specific example. Years ago, I was hired to do psychological assessments for a bank called Connecticut Bank and Trust, and the CEO, his name was James Conley or Conway, I forgot his name. He went on to buy a Bank of New England. He was looking for a COO. What he said was he was looking for someone who knew how to stand up to him. But in my interviews with him and my interviews with the subordinates, that was not him at all. He was really looking for somebody who basically would do what Jim would say. So there was this guy that I interviewed for the job. I would have hired him, but I'm working for Jim Conway. And I told this guy, based on my assessment, I think it would be a really bad fit and you'd be very unhappy. You're what Jim says he's looking for, but that's not what he's looking for. And the guy was very polite and professional and said, yeah. Well, Jim Conway went on to buy Bank of New England and he destroyed Bank of New England. He destroyed Connecticut Bank and Trust. They all went bankrupt. This guy went on to become president of Middlesex Savings Bank. He tracked me down, brought me lunch, and he said, you know, I hated you when you turned me down, but now that I see what actually happened, what happened in my career, it was a real blessing. Those are the kinds of things I live for.
I overlooked having everybody do their introduction, so sorry about that. So instead, we'll do it now. So I want to stop with that. And again, this is very quick. This is not a 30-second commercial. Just your name, title, and the first time. What this is about is so that.